Thanks for joining us for Dialogue on a Wednesday afternoon. I'm Brandon Hollingsworth at 91.9 FM WUOT, your NPR news station. Appalachia's the place to be, at least for reporters and columnists searching for, well, exactly what are they searching for? An explanation for Donald Trump's appeal, the plight of former coal towns, explanations for the rise of the alt-right. Yeah, all of the above, and more, too. Our guest today says Appalachia is often used as a canvas, allowing commentators and pundits to paint whatever picture they like. And she says it's usually way off the mark. Dr. Elizabeth Catt is a consultant, historian, and writer. She studied at UT and earned her PhD at MTSU. She's the author of the forthcoming book, What You Are Getting Wrong About Appalachia, which is slated to come out early next year. And she's with us for this hour on Dialogue. Dr. Catt, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Yes, indeed. Thank you for joining us today. And I want to let everybody know we want to hear from you, too. We have a box set up on our Facebook page where you can submit a question about the myths of modern Appalachia. You can tweet us at WUOTFM. Some folks have already done that. Or you can join us the old-fashioned way. We're going to open up the phone lines here. In about 15 minutes, we'll give you the number here shortly. Elizabeth, I want to start first with your own background. You're not the Yale academic who's coming in from outside to tell us old Appalachians what's going on. You're one of us. What is your own background?
So, great question. My background is I was born and raised in East Tennessee. My grandparents are from East Tennessee and also Southwest Virginia. So, on one side of my family, I have coal miners, and on the other side of my family, I have people who were sort of forced into migration by the TVA. So these are very typical stories that people have when they're from Appalachia. I lived in East Tennessee for 30 years, but traveled a little bit to do my PhD and do some work in my field. But now I'm back after a year living in Texas to set the record straight about Appalachia.
All right, I'm going to put you to that test, by the way.
Exactly.
How did you get into Appalachian studies? I mean, what drew you to this kind of genre?
So I need to confess that I'm not actually an expert in Appalachian studies. Okay. I'm a historian. I'm a public historian. Always have a lifelong interest in Appalachian history. But primarily, I am a historian of memory. And so what that means is I'm very interested in the way people remember the past and how people misremember the past. And this has always been the link that's connected me to Appalachian history, the way that myths, like we're going to talk about today, sort of enter the public consciousness, how they get used and reshaped over time. And so my interest in public history, what the public thinks about history, made me sort of naturally attuned to Appalachian history. And of course, being from Appalachia myself helps. But it was this moment, you know, during the election and the success of Hillbilly Elegy, when we had sort of a reawakening and rediscovery of Appalachia in the public consciousness, and working in the field where myths and memory are kind of very relevant to what I do, it was a opportunity for me to start first venting some frustration at the way the region has been depicted, but also sort of trace where some of these myths and fantasies about Appalachia come from.
That was actually going to be my next question, is when you started to notice this drumbeat of inaccurate reporting or commentary that you felt was distorted, do you remember a particular piece
Yes.
or genre? Tell me about it.
Yeah, so I'll put it down that I think my first recollection of the genre that I write about in my book and some of my personal writings, this Trump country genre that uses Appalachia as a template to understand the rise of Donald Trump, was in February of 2015. In Vanity Fair, an article appropriately titled Trump Country USA. And so this was
nothing subtle about
subtle about it. And it was a travelogue of the author's accumulated experiences in sort of Charleston, Morgantown, West Virginia. And the theme of it was, to understand Donald Trump, you must understand Appalachia. To understand Appalachia, you must understand Donald Trump. And so this momentum really built as political forecasting took shape, as primaries started happening, and all but exploded after the West Virginia primary in May 2016.
And that's something that's interesting, by the way, that I've seen in other writings, and I can't remember if it was you or somebody else who wrote this, that the West Virginia primary and now President Trump's performance in that primary got a lot of play for that, for a lot of reasons. One, because some of those counties used to be Union Democratic strongholds. It also fit a narrative about white working class Americans that Donald Trump seemed to be resonating with. But the actual county, to my knowledge, that got the highest percentage of Republican voters in the primary to vote for Donald Trump was Staten Island, New York.
Yeah.
So it had nothing to do with West Virginia at all. So we're already starting with kind of what you're saying is a flawed premise that really grew from that point forward. I can only imagine your frustrations probably grew as well.
Well, I think a great example to look at how these narratives sort of explode and take shape and become detached from reality is if you look at the accumulation of pieces, and we were talking about this a little bit before we went on air, about McDowell County, West Virginia. And so I lost count at about 22 or 23 profiles in mainstream publications, very prestige publications like the New Yorker or Vanity Fair, or the Washington Post, about this county in West Virginia that has 17,000 registered voters, although the number in circulation is probably a little bit lower than that. But Ted Koppel called it unambiguously Trump country. The Guardian said that Donald Trump was more popular in McDowell County than anywhere else in America. And so now that we have the benefit of hindsight, we know the election results, and we know that McDowell County gave Donald Trump around 700 votes in the Republican primary, and about 5,500 votes in the general election. So, you know, McDowell County wasn't necessarily Trump country. It's probably more accurate to say that McDowell County was the county that nobody really cared enough to vote county, which is true around a lot of counties in Appalachia, particularly the poorest counties in Appalachia.
We should say, too, that the sort of the historical dismissal of Appalachia or trying to use the people or the region as a starting off point for conversation is not restricted, you know, by any kind of partisan boundaries. I mean, this happens on the left and the right to try to push or pull Appalachia or fit it into a template that best serves whatever point a politician is trying to make.
Right. These narratives are popular, as you said, by people of all political stripes, both sides of the political aisle. Hillbilly LG, for example, this sort of like uber narrative of Appalachia is widely beloved by people on the left and the right. So they take different things out of these narratives, I think, people on the left and the right. People on the right tend to look at these narratives for proof that we have left a certain group of people, a certain class of people, the white working class, behind. And people on the left tend to look at these narratives as proof that we need to empathize more with people who are on the margins of our awareness. So they take different things from these narratives, but the universality of the sort of Appalachian, forgotten Appalachia, is pretty powerful.
I know that you've done a lot of pushback on your blog about this, and we talked about at the top of the show, you have a book coming out early next year. As this began to coalesce in your mind, this idea of not liking what you were seeing coming out of these prestigious publications or media sources, how did that begin to form in your mind of a plan of action? Like, I need to say something about this. Here's how I want to do it. What motivated you to go from beyond just being frustrated to wanting to actively combat it?
So the thing that I found most concerning about the early Appalachian pieces, early Trump country pieces that I was seeing was this tendency of the authors to sort of use the plight of Appalachians, real or presumed, to sort of deflect the growing acceptance of racism and misogyny and xenophobia in Trump's campaign and among his base. So the idea was, is if we look at these poor working class people, lower income people, jobless, without hope, filled with despair, it's easier for us to detach the political momentum that was building from some of the very troublesome things promised by a Trump victory, so border walls and travel bans and things of that nature. Those left your mind a little bit when you were sort of in the clicking through video logs about McDowell County or, you know, Eastern Kentucky. They were trying to make the point that what we were seeing could be distilled as a kind of broad economic anxiety detached from the other things that we should be talking about when we're talking about the rise of the politics that we were experiencing and now will continue to experience.
I want to get back to this point, too. We're going to take a station break shortly, but because I don't want to get us into a 10-minute answer when we have like 3 minutes left, but I'm fascinated by that. That term, economic anxiety, which we've all heard pretty extensively over the last year and a half or so, almost exclusively applied to these places and these people. It's almost always going to be about economic anxiety. What is the mythology of that? I mean, how big a role does, I mean, you were saying that it was sort of used as a sort of a paper over for some maybe more unseemly root causes for President Trump's support or what people were feeling in these parts of the country. What role did economic anxiety actually play in what's going on right now?
Well, I mean, your guess is as good as mine there. I don't think that we've been able to untangle it completely. Economic anxiety is real. I think what we most often see is that people are reacting to realities and daily things that they experience in their everyday lives that are causing them anxiety, that they're thinking about the loss of their status and their weight, but they're just blaming the wrong set of circumstances or the wrong set of experiences. So economic anxiety is real, but we have to look deeper than the answers that these pieces often give us.
If you had to create a template, I mean, it's almost a genre. You talked about it as the Trump Country USA type thing. I called it Coal Country USA before we started.
Exactly.
It's like you and I were talking about the same kind of story.
Mm-hmm.
We hear it on NPR. We get it from the Washington Post. We hear they go to the diner in Brevard, North Carolina, and they talk to some people, and then boom, that's the view. That's my story. Here it is, beginning, middle, and end. If you had to create a template of the things that bug you the most, that crop up most frequently, what are those stories like for people who may want to recognize them in their own media consumption?
I think the thing that I'm most aware of is the sense that people in regions like Appalachia are monolithic, that they only tell one story, that there's only one race or group of people that live there, that there's one brand of politics, and that there's one economy.
That there's this idea that of homogeneity through the entire region, which, by the way, the Appalachians themselves reach at least from upstate New York down to about Montgomery, Alabama. They're across cultural lines, there are racial lines, economic. One of your main points that I've seen on your blog and in your writing is that there's a lot more diversity than these pieces, and maybe even we who live here in Appalachia seem to recognize.
There's different sorts of economic diversity going on in the region. One of the things that is really frustrating about these genres is the way that they wed the entire region to the coal industry. And that comes very close to our reality, which is to say that there's not many aspects, many areas of the region that are untouched by the coal industry. Here in East Tennessee, for example, we don't mine coal, but we burn coal through the TVA. So instead of looking at sort of the nuances of the coal industry, we see the industry projected as the face of a white, out-of-work coal miner. And so we have to kind of question why those choices are made. Why are we projecting coal and all the kind of baggage that comes with the coal industry on a person rather than looking at it as a really sophisticated sort of economic system and mono-economy that's come to the region?
We'll come back to that in just a few moments. We're also going to open the phone lines. We'd love to hear from you. Don't forget, we are online, of course. You can tweet us at WUOTFM. You can go to our Facebook page and leave a question there. And, of course, as I said, we'll take phone calls coming up just after the break at 19 minutes after the hour. This is Dialogue from WUOT News.